been probably a little over a year since the last time I introduced anybody by Mishmar. I'm usually not here, but I made a special effort to come for Rabbi Horowitz. we used to say announcements. Do they say announcements anymore by Mishmar? Huh? Do we have any announcements? Shavuos is coming. And there's going to be, if anybody didn't know yet, and there's going to be an email going out tomorrow, whoever gets our emails, and if you don't, speak to somebody that does. Our schedule we're going to have here, it's going to be a gewaldike maimed. Anybody should come, they could see. It's going to be food, drinks, cakes, and some Torah. Agav. There's going to be shiurim for children all night long. From 12:30 to 5:30, from 12:30 to 5:30, and there's going to Rabbi Blaise will be here learning with people. I'll be here learning with people. The Ingalite will be here, and it'll be very, very nice. All the our tefillahs are going to be Newland Gardens, but the learning will be here in Shai Tefillah. There will be a Ne'ilas HaChag at Rabbi Singer's house, 1080 Northeast 178th Terrace, which will be obviously by Ne'ilas HaChag by the second day of Yom Tov. At my house. With that, it's a very big schuss for all of us. I think this could be the first time Howard's is saying a mishmar in the kollel. Is that true?
Yeah.
Avi Sherman says it's not. What is that? He spoke by a Benzinger recently. And it's a very big schuss for all of us. I heard Rabbi Howard's. The first time I heard Rabbi Howard speak was that Rabbi Benzinger's through his advice, and it was mamish a gewaltige, gewaltige Israelis. And it's a big schuss we have him back. Well, back in NMB, and with that, just Rabbi Howitz. Sorry, he's the Rav Bardas of Williams Island Synagogue.
Thank you, Rabbi. Brishus, the Rosh Hakoilo, Rav Blazer Shlita, Rav Singer Shlita, the Avreichim, Chavrei Hakoilo, Moronon Verabonon, members of the community. It is a great honor and privilege right before Yom Tov that celebrates Matan Torah for me to address the bearers of the Aron HaBris of our community. And concerning the Aron, the Torah tells us, "Bitabos ha'Aron yu abadim lo yisurim yemenu." The badei ha'Aron, the poles that were affixed to the ark were never to be removed. They were installed permanently. And this was true in spite of the fact that there were a number of other kelim in the Mishkan which also had badim, they also had poles, but those poles were removable. And the Meshech Chochm explains the difference. If when the Aron was at rest, we would be allowed to remove those poles, those badim, we might draw the mistaken conclusion that the badei ha'Aron, the poles, were utilitarian, that they serve a practical purpose. They were needed for transportation. But once the transporting is completed, they no longer serve a useful purpose and they could be removed. But in truth, the Aron is singularly unique in that it is noisei es noisov. It carries those that carry it. The Torah therefore, continues the Meshech Chochma, commanded that the Badim remain in the Aron, in the Ark, permanently, as they are merely decorative and not functional. So whereas the common misconception is that the Zvulons, with their financial support, it is they that carry the Yisochas. But Adarabba, I realize that as much as we rely and seek to enlist the support of the Zvulons, it is ultimately the Chavrei HaKoilel, the Yungalite, the Rosh HaKoilel, members of the community such as yourselves, who are makdish their evenings and are steeped in Limud HaTorah, who carry and sustain the rest of us, including my kehillah in Williams Island. And for that I am eternally grateful. My bracha is that all those who learn here, the kollel, everyone in the community should forever be cognizant of the esteem in which you are all held. That you should be zoicha to the bracha of Yalu Eva Kanashorim, that with renewed strength you should continue to be mashpia on the entire community, uplifting yourselves and in the process exalting all of us. My presentation tonight is comprised of three parts. One chelik is devoted to machshava, a second to lamdas, light lamdas, And the opening section will focus on a curious tidbit of Jewish history. All three, I believe, relate to some aspect of Maimed Har Sinai. And for purposes of tying it all together and giving it some cohesion, I've taken the liberty of titling the shiur, The Quality of Sight, Sound, and Soul at Har Sinai and its Implications for Us Today. From our earliest childhood, it has been impressed upon each and every one of us that we were all there for Kabbalah Satorah. Ki es asher yeshnoi poi imanu hayom lifnei Hashem elokeinu, v'yeis asher einenu poi imanu hayom. We believe that every neshama was present at Har Sinai to receive the magical, magnificent words of Torah. All of us were there to witness the single most important event in the history of mankind. We experienced the awe-inspiring spectacle, the koilos, the brokim, the thunder, the lightning, the sound of the shofar, and insofar as the quality of sight is concerned, we all, I believe, caught a glimpse of the great lawgiver himself, Moshe Rabbeinu. Let's stop for a moment and allow me to propose the following. If you were around 3,300 years ago, you were working for CNN, you were assigned to cover the biblical sojournings of the Jewish people and the arch-revolutionary leader Moshe Rabbeinu, the many roles that he played in Mitzrayim, from prince to fugitive to a refugee to an outspoken, courageous foe of Paro. How would you describe him? What would you say about the man who, by force of his personality and character, was able to leave a motley group, a multitude of slaves, from abject bondage and poverty to the fresh and bright light of freedom? What picture would you paint? What reports would you send back? Obviously, you couldn't supply a photograph, but at the very least, you would have an artist's portrait to accompany a profile of this historical giant. Our Torah actually gives us an interesting account of Moshe. Vayehi beredes Moshe mahar Sinai ushnei luchos ha'edes biyad Moshe beriditoi min ahor. Moshe lo yoda ki koran or ponov bedabarito. It came to pass that when Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain with the luchos in his hands, he did not know that the skin on his face was shining. It sent forth, says the Torah, beams, rays of light. Hayar Aaron v'chol b'nei Yisrael is Moshe. When Aaron and Knesset Yisrael saw Moshe, they saw how his face glistened with an intense sheen. They were afraid to come close and approach him. Now the word Keren or Koran means horns. Michelangelo, in his great painting of Moshe, represented the lawgiver as having horns protruding from his forehead. But that, of course, was a misinterpretation of our Torah. For the word Keren means a ray, as a ray of light shone upon his face, a light radiating from his face. However, the assignment given to you as a media correspondent is not nearly as far-fetched as it may seem. There is a very, very fascinating story told by one of the great Gedolim of the 19th century, one of the great rabbinic luminaries, at Tiferes Yisrael, the great commentator of the Mishnah, the author of the classic work Yochanan Boaz, the rabbi of the Danzig community in Europe, Harav Yisroel Lipschitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Were it not for the fact that the story that I'm about to tell you appears in his Pirish in the commentary at the end of Maseches Kedushin, I would dismiss it as an unadulterated Bubba Maisa. But let me tell you the story, and though you may not believe it, its implications for all of us are self-evident. The legend, as recorded in the Tiferes Yisrael, relates that when Moshe Rabbeinu became famous for leading Klal Yisrael out of Egypt and presenting them with the Torah, an Arabian king sent and commissioned an artist to the Machne Yisrael to paint a portrait of Moshe. The artist went to the Midbar, to the wilderness, and indeed painted a portrait and brought it back to Arabia. Upon reviewing the portrait, the king summoned his physiognomist. I never heard of the word in my life, but the Tiferes Yisrael uses the word physiognomist. He spells it out in Lashon Kodesh. And physiognomists are those experts who can look at a portrait or a face and judge character on the basis of a person's facial features. But the king really wanted to know was wherein lies the secret of Moshe Rabbeinu's strength. And so the physiognomist prepared a written report, and the report, based on the picture on the painting was not a pleasant one. Moshe Rabbeinu, the lawgiver, was described as being capricious, greedy, arrogant, basically wicked to the core. When the king heard it, he got very angry. "Are you talking? How could this be?" He rebuked the physiognomist. For based on the newspaper headlines, it could not be consistent with everything that he heard about Moshe. "It's impossible," he said. He concluded that their analysis was patently absurd. At that point, the physiognomist and the portrait artist started hurling accusations and blaming one another. The physiognomist said that the artist is a schlemazel, and he did not depict Moshe properly. The artist, on the other hand, countered and said, "Look, I presented you with an accurate picture. You, the physiognomist, have obviously misinterpreted the painting." The king of Arabia, this king, decided to resolve the matter for himself. So he took a visit to the Machne Yisrael in Midbar Sinai so that he could see for himself. He brought along the painting, and as soon as he saw Moshe Rabbeinu from a distance, he removed the portrait, he took a look at Moshe, and he knew at once that the artist's rendition was accurate and done with precision. The portrait and what he saw were one and the same. The king concluded that the physiognomists were competent. However, before returning to his Maluch in Arabia, the king figured he traveled so far, he might as well get an audience with Moshe Rabbeinu. He met the great lawgiver, and Moshe asked him the purpose of his visit. The Arabian king told him the whole story. Moshe Rabbeinu assured the king that his physiognomist had not made a mistake. They were just as competent as the portrait artist. Moshe continued to explain that by inclination he was all the physiognomist had described, but much worse, that only through sustained sheer discipline, through determination, was he able to overcome to be miskaber al midosav, his innate character and predisposition for evil, and attain the stature and glory that were now his. This is the complete, unembellished story that's found in the writings of the Tiferes Yisroel, Rabbi Yisroel Lipschitz, the great Goyen from Danzig. The matter, though, does not conclude with this story. After it was published in the 1800s, a series of pamphlets were issued both in Europe and Yerushalayim denouncing the Tiferes Yisroel, with Rav Lipschitz viewed as a supreme compliment to Moshe Rabbeinu, that he worked to transcend his evil character and achieve excellence as an individual, was seen by others as a gratuitous insult. In their view, this version of the internalized transformation of Moshe Rabbeinu from sinner to saint was ludicrous. It's impossible, they argued, that Moshe was anything but righteous and pure from the moment he set foot in this world. And to support their contention, they cited the verse which records the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Miriam observed that the little baby in the basket was good. Rashi quotes the Medrash from Soita, that Kishenoilad Nismali Habayas Kuloira. The insult was compounded by the fact that no Medrash, no early source seemed to support the account of the transformation of Moshe Rabbeinu. And broadsides and denunciations against the Tiferes Yisroel were not long in coming. In 1894, the great Lithuanian Magid, Harav Chaim Aaron Rappaport, began publishing a series of pamphlets against the Tiferes Yisroel. And one of those pamphlets again said that in his view, Moshe was a tzaddik gomor from the moment he was born. He cited the famous Medrash, Kishenoilad Nismale Habayis Kuloira. How could you say that Moshe was inclined to evil from birth, if from the moment he was first seen, he was glowing? Many Rabbonim, including Harav Avraham Yitzchak HaKoyen Kuk, Israel's first chief rabbi, denounced the passage as smacking of heresy. They asserted that no early source supported this account, that it was mistakenly borrowed from the writings of Cicero, who told the exact same story concerning Socrates. By far the most strident denunciation came from the pen of Rabbi Yehuda Leib Maimon, a famous religious Zionist, Israel's first minister of religion. Parenthetically, he wrote a wonderful collection called Sorei Hameya, which is biographies of great Gedolim. In 1955, he published an article and suggested in no uncertain terms that the offensive passage be expunged from all editions of the Tiferes Yisroel. Indeed, a year later, When the 13th volume edition of the Mishnah was reprinted in Eretz Yisrael, that passage concerning the portrait of Moses was airbrushed out of the printed edition. I have a Yochanan Boaz at home. It so happens it's in there. Maybe you have it here in the Beis Medrash. You can take a look. It's a very fascinating tidbit of Jewish history. And I should add, despite the vehement opposition to this account from many Rabbonim, it has been favorably received and regarded as accurate in Chassidish circles, going back to the time of the Baal Shem Tov. But at the crux of the issue of whether one can vouch for the portrait of Moshe Rabbeinu's historical authenticity, I believe looms an even larger fundamental debate. Who is greater, the Yid who is virtuous naturally, or the one who is virtuous only after a struggle, who has to work hard to refashion his character and transform vice into virtue? I would venture to say that those who venture that the passage in the Tiferes Yisrael is offensive maintain that the truly great people are characterized not by struggle, but rather by inner harmony. The Tiferes Yisrael, though not a Chassidish Rebbe, would argue that the greater Jew is the one who has to struggle to remold his character, to transcend negative qualities, or as the Rambam says, "B'mokoyim shebali tshuva imdim, ein tzadikim gemurim yecholim lamaychav." A similar story is told of Rabbi Yosha ben Soloveitchik, the grandfather of Chaim Brisker, who was a tremendous Baal Chesed, an exemplar of Gemilas Chasodim. He took it upon himself to help almonis, to help women in distress, and he championed their cause and their plight. And he often would explain that it is not because by nature I am a kind, or gracious, or giving person. Quite the contrary. I am naturally an unfeeling, miserable, callous person. However, the Torah and mitzvahs have dictated that I transcend my natural inclinations and predisposition and perform mitzvahs and ma'asim tovim. Michelangelo was absolutely incorrect in depicting Moshe as some supernatural human being with horns of glory emanating from his forehead. Moshe, though the closest thing to a malach, was unmistakably a great man. He was human to the core. His portrait is the portrait of a man who transformed himself from an introverted kfad peh, kfad loshen, inarticulate, unable to climb outside from his own shell to become the great manik, to become the great teacher of the Klal Yisrael, of the children of Israel. But the Tiferes Yisrael's story, truthfully, has implications for modern 21st century man. We are so conditioned by the advances of modern science that we often forgo our God-given right of free choice, and we accept the mistaken notion that we are fated or doomed by forces over which we have absolutely no control. We read constantly in magazines and newspapers of genetic tendencies that preordain our behavior and govern our actions. It is as if we have lost control, that we are robots responding to the dictates of genetic DNA materials which fuel our behavior. And the Torah says no. Moshe says, "Achayim v'amodes nasati lefanecha. I've given you life and death. Ubacharta b'chayim, choose life." Though undoubtedly it is true we are limited by nature and environment, nevertheless, there are vast areas in the realm of Tov and Rav, good and evil, where the decision is ours and ours alone. You can choose, you can make a difference, and you can transform your character. The whole message of the Yemei HaSfira, beginning with Pesach and culminating with Shavuos and Matan Torah, is that we can divest ourselves of the accumulated baggage of all our yesterdays. That with Kabbalah's Torah we can start fresh. We can be true b'nei chayrin to make enlightened moral decisions. We can experience a rebirth like newborn babes, which is a perfect segue for the next topic. The Gemara in Yevamos Daf Chaf Beis tells us that gersh in iskaya kekotin shenoy ladomi. A goy, a Gentile who converts to Judaism, it is as if he or she is born anew, which means that al pi dinei Torah, a father and a daughter that convert and become yidden can marry one another. The Chassam Sofer in his Chedushim Tavoy de Zohar writes, and I quote, "Ki niskashe kol yomai meheichen hoitziyu chazal dofase v'yogati harbei v'loi mutsosi minolei l'rabon en hodiger k'shiniskaya k'kotin shenoy ladomi." My whole life, he says, the Chassam Sofer, I'm bothered. Where did Chazal come up with this idea? What is the source for this halacha? That gersh and iskaya k'kotin shenoy ladomi. Rav Meir Simchin is Meshech's Chochm in Parshas Veschanan says L'dayti Poshit. It's simple. I have the answer. The makor for this halacha, he says, is Maimed Har Sinai. At Har Sinai we became Jews. In fact, all Dine Geiris, the fact that you need tefillah, the fact that you need a korban, it is all derived from Maimed Har Sinai. And the Gemara in Krisa says, Ma v'yaseichem le'nichnesu le'bris ela b'milu tefillah v'artzoas dam. Avheim le'nichnesu le'bris ela b'milu tefillah v'artzoas dam. The very same procedure which effectuated the transformation of our ancestors and made them Jews at Har Sinai is required of any goy, of any Gentile wishing to convert. And we know that at Maimon Har Sinai, Klal Yisrael was told, Shuvu li aleichem, return to your tents. And the Gemara in Moed Katan says that it means we're told to return and resume relations with their wives. But according to the new Torah that was just promulgated, was just given, many relationships would have to be severed. They're arayas, they're prohibited. Certain people could no longer remain with their wives, namely couples similar to that of Amram and Yocheved, which is a nephew married to his aunt. Al pi dinei haTorah, this would qualify as one of the arayas and would be also. So we must say, continues Rav Meir Simcha, that gersh and iskaya kekotin shenoy ladomi. And the Meilet, there are no more nephews, no more aunts. Everybody after Maimed Har Sinai is unrelated. Everyone can marry anyone. The Meshech Chochma, one of the great Torah giants, I should mention parenthetically, was 6'3". Another very tall rabbi, the Maral, who was called the Hoicharov, was also tall. He totally disagrees with Rav Meir Simcha. In Parshas Vayigash, we're told that Shimon had a child, Shol ben Aknanis. So Chazal is surprised. How could it be that Shimon, a son of Yaakov, would marry Aknanis? The others were so makpid, as you know, not to marry Aknanis. So Rashi quotes the Medrash that Shimon married his sister Dina. She's referred to as Aknanis because of the Maisa with Shem. So he didn't marry Aknanis, but he married his sister. How does that make things any better? Marrying a sister, especially a sister from the same father and the same mother, is one of the arayas. It's also midaraisa. So the Maral says, "Gersh in iskaya kikotin shenoy ladomi." Prior to Matan Torah, there was no chiyuv to uphold the Torah. So each generation, each door, prior to the revelation at Sinai, took it upon themselves to accept the Torah. They were geirim. The geirim, they are unrelated. They can marry one another. And even Shimon can marry his sister Dina. The Maral then continues. Does this now mean that we can say that since at Matan Torah they became Geirim, that siblings, brothers and sisters, should be able to marry one another? He says that is an impossibility. Not like the Meshech Chochma. It's impossible. The Pasuk says, V'yaham boichel mishpachosav. The people were crying, Al iskei arayos, once they learned that the arayas were also, but if they are all a bunch of geirim and are unrelated to one another, there should be no such thing as arayas. No relationship should be prohibited. It must be, continues the Maral, that at Har Sinai there was no concept of gersh and iskaya kekotin shenoy ladomi. Why? Because kof aleihem har kegigas, they were coerced. The Rabbanu shel Olam, as it were, held the mountain over their heads like a barrel, and they were forced. It's one thing if a ger converts with a lev sholem and a nefesh chafetza, so you say kekotin shenoy ladomi. But when a geris is done through coercion, you don't say gersh in iskaya kekotin shenoy ladomi. This is a very famous maral. The Shev Shmaisa, the Balak Soyas and his Hakdoma, the Klei Chemda, and many others speak about this. It made waves. It shook the world. The question that has to be asked based on this maral is, how are we considered Jewish if we were forced? L'chayra, the whole geiris is forfallen. If you would take a gun and hold it to a guy's head and force him to be Magaya, the geiris is meaningless. So why by Klal Yisrael at Har Sinai should it be any different? And as I mentioned earlier, all the laws concerning Dinei Geiris are derived from Sinai. We say that we're considered Mushpa V'Yomei Bar Sinai. Maral seems to be saying that even though there was kviya that we were coerced, the geirus somehow did kick in, but not to the degree that we should say kikotin shenoy ladami. So my manashav, is it 90%? Is it 100%? If the process was not 100%, then the geirus should be nullified. Where do you draw the line? What does the maral mean? I'd like to share with you two biurim on this maral. One is found in Sefer Apirion by Rav Shloimeh Gansfried, the author of Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And it so happens that Rav Huttner in Pachad Yitzchok says bidiyuk the same thing. And the second mahalach is from the Klei Chemda. Rav Huttner, I think, says as follows. Whenever there is coercion, whenever there's kfiyah for a yid to do mitzvahs, we say, koifin oisai ad sheyomer roitzani. We force him until he says yes. But how do you know that he truly wants and desires what you want him to do? So there was a famous Rambam, everyone knows this Rambam, in Hilchas Gerish and Perek Beis Halacha Chof. He says that deep down every yid is clamoring and chalashing to do Rotzen Hashem. What about the fact that he's adamant and he's screaming Chai V'Kayim that he doesn't want to give a get? So the answer is that's not really him. That's the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara has taken him hostage. It's not him. The kunz of the Yetzer Hara is that he tries to tell you that this is what you want. But in reality, it's not you. It's a foreigner that's injected into us. And he's trying to persuade us that what he wants is what we really want. But Bamasin, we really do not want what he has to offer. So when Bezdin forces him to give a get, to do a mitzvah, and he finally gives in and says, Reitzani, he's released from the grip of the Yetzer Hara. His true self emerges. And what emerges is his true pnimius. This is what the Rambam says. And the get is kosher l'mahadrin. Now where do we get this idea that deep down every Jew wants to carry out Ratzon Hashem? The Teretz is from Maimon Har Sinai. And even though the experience at Sinai was the product of kfiyah, we invoke the Rambam's idea that deep down every Jew has a profound yearning to be mekabel mitzvahs, to carry out Ratzon Hashem. Where does that profound, deep down yearning come from? Muzman Zogin will have to say, continues Rav Huttner, that since we stam from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the others, their whole mahus was to do Ratzon Hashem. So we, their descendants, inherited that. That quality of yearning inheres innately in us. We are their descendants. So the whole geirus of Knesset Yisrael was effective based on their lineage, based on their roots, based on their past. Without this connection to the others, the geirus wouldn't work. That is to say, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu were to hold the mountain over the Brazilians or the Italians or the English Goyim, it would not work. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on the other hand, held the mountain over the Jewish people. It worked. Because deep down we want to do Ratzon Hashem. And that comes from the Yovis, which means that we are based on our past. But the concept, listen carefully, the concept of Geirus by its very definition means that you are disconnected and severed from your past. So how can you rely on your lineage and at the same time be disconnected from your lineage simultaneously? It's an impossibility. It's an oxymoron. Bishlama, by a regular Geirus, the former Gentile is coming to convert and cut off all association to his past. So I can understand it works. We say, can the cotton shenoyla dummy? He has severed all ties to his former life. We consider him a newborn. But the Ganze Geirus for a Jew, we're saying, is effective only because of his past. A Geirus which is nourished from one's past and based on one's past cannot simultaneously disconnect you from your past. A geirus that is geboit and predicated on your past cannot be mafkia you from your past. And memeil at Har Sinai, we are precluded from applying the principle of geirus in iskaya kekotin shenoy ladomi. This is what Rav Huttner says. The same idea is found in Sefer Apirion. The Klei Chemda, Rav Meir Don Plotsky, has an entirely different mahalach. And Lefi Anias Daiti, it's more Maharaldic than Rav Huttner's approach. He says as follows. Imagine a person saying the following. He says the statement, I was forced to begin. Is there a problem with that statement? I was forced to begin. So in Yahadus, that statement is untenable. It's an impossibility. The statement, I was forced to begin, does not make any sense, because if I am forced, there can't be a beginning. To be forced would mean that I still belong to a previous system, which is dictating today what I should do, and that cannot be called a beginning. A beginning means that there is nothing that precedes you, and you're starting fresh, you're starting from scratch. Nothing is forcing you. You do not belong to anything yet. To be forced, by definition, always means stage two. A good example would be the difference between a korban nedava and a korban chayva. A korban nedava is voluntary. A korban chayva is forced. The halach is, by a korban chayva, you can be yored l'nechasav. A korban chayva means that yesterday a person did an aveira, which obligates him to bring a korban today. By a korban nedava, there is no yesterday. He wakes up and decides to bring, he wants to bring a korban. He's starting from scratch. Chayva means it's at least stage two. And by that time, I can already be forced. Again, a beginning, by definition, can only be done b'rotzen. If it's done b'kfiyah, through coercion, then it's not a beginning. The meila, the kli chemda, continues. The maral has to mean as follows. If Klal Yisrael at Har Sinai is poised to receive a Torah, and is at the threshold, is at the haskalah, a new beginning, how can they possibly be forced? If it's a beginning, and they're starting from scratch, how can there be kfiyah? Muzmin Zog, and again you have to say, that Maimed Har Sinai and the receiving of the Torah is not a beginning of a process. Because if it's the beginning of a process, there cannot be kfiyah. It must be that it's the conclusion of a process which started with the Shibud in Mitzrayim, continued with the Eser Makas, culminating ultimately with Tavdanis Elokim Al Haharazeh. And Gershon is Gaya, Kekotin Shinoila Domi is only relevant again to the beginning of a process. Matan Torah is the conclusion of a process. Something which is a Hemshech cannot be a Haskalah. Memela, says the Kli Chemda, you cannot say Gershon is Gaya, Kekotin Shinoila Domi. And the halach of the Kli Chemda, by the way, is echoed many times in the writings of the Maral. For example, in this week's parasha, it says, V'yela told us Aaron, U'moshe b'yoim, Dibur Hashem is Moshe. These are the children of Aaron and Moshe. And the next pasuk lists only the children of Aaron. Why does it say, told us Moshe, if only the children of Aaron are being mentioned? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, from here we learn, Kol hamalame ben chaveroi Torah, male olavakos of kilu yilodoi. In actuality, Moshe was responsible for teaching his nephews. He taught Aaron's children Torah. When you teach the children of your chaver Torah, it becomes parental. It's as if you've given birth to them. So the Maral asks a good kasha. For that matter, Moshe didn't just teach Aaron's children. He's not called Moshe Rabinowitz. He's called Moshe Rabbeinu. He's the teacher of Gans Klal Yisrael. He taught all of us. So there should have been a list in the Torah the size of the Manhattan Yellow Pages. Why does it mention just the name of Aaron's sons? Moshe taught every member of Klal Yisrael. So the Maral answers that when it comes to Klal Yisrael, Moshe Rabbeinu had no choice. The Rabbanu Shel Olam commanded him to teach Klal Yisrael. He had to do it. But Aaron's children, he tutored them on a voluntary basis. That taka is ki'ilu yilodoi, because leida means giving birth, which is a haskalah, and a haskalah can only be berotz. And this is what the Maral says. Irrespective of how we view the mechanics of how Klal Yisrael became a covenantal community, and exactly how the Geiris works, as we ourselves prepare for Kabbalah Satorah, we have to realize that the quality of the Jewish soul is such that Michad Gisa, there is a Chi of Gomor, that we are Avdei Hashem, receiving orders, and Yiddishkeit is absolutely compulsory. Me'idach Gisa, there is no Leida without Rotzen, without a desire. And as Yidden, there has to be a Tshuka, there has to be a Shi'ifa, where it is called Gufay Margish, that every fiber of our being is absolutely thrilled and elated to be Mekabel Ol Mitzvahs and to have this obligation. In terms of the last element, the element of sound, there was a powerful summons issued to every Yid at Sinai. I'd like to conclude with a powerful machshav again from Rav Hutner, but allow me to preface it with the following story. Prior to my entering the Rabbonis, my wife and I used to spend Pesach with my parents in Queens, New York. my father, he should live and be well. We would typically daven Yom Tov night at a shtibel, a small shul a few blocks away from our home. The attendees at this shul were predominantly Ungarish Shayidin, Hungarian Holocaust survivors. And Pesach was a particularly sad time for them. Many of the people in the shul were deported in the spring of 1944. And their celebration of Pesach coincided with their arrival at Auschwitz. The Yisker of Pesach took on a new meaning for these survivors who all shared, as it turns out, the same yurt sites. The lack of identifiable grave plots and stones for their parents and loved ones who perished was replaced with the eternal epitaph and mental monument of Yisker. But what happened at this particular shul, Pesach night, about 20 years ago, will remain with me as long as I live. I came close up and intimate with the horrific aspect of the Holocaust that until then existed for me only in books and documentaries. The Kehillah had just finished davening mincha, and a man with a white beard, an itztel of the Rabbon, and a chassidish garb, a kapot, and a strimal, he got up to be the shliach tzibur to daven ma'ariv. No sooner had he uttered the word Baruch Hu that a good number of the congregation with flushed white faces as if responding on cue, they picked themselves up and they left the shul. We, the remaining few who comprised the minyan, finished the davening. We were shocked to learn that the exodus from the shul was on account of the fact that the individual who led the davening was the very kapo who tormented them in Auschwitz. And the kapos, as you know, were inmates in the camps. They were often Yidden who were appointed by the Nazi camp authorities, Yimach Shemam, to ensure that their fellow prisoners maintained order and adequately fulfilled their work quotas. Some were political prisoners who tried to obtain limited relief for the people under their nominal control, and others actually were quite brutal in carrying out their assignments. Following the war, this particular Yid, he resuscitated his life and apparently became religiously committed, but the people at the shul that night could not reconcile his newfound piety with forever fresh images indelibly etched on their psyche of the role that he played in Auschwitz. There is a postscript to this story. In my second year as a Rav in Williams Island, I was invited to join local Rabbonim in Malava Malka, a Saturday night at Sifa in Malava Malka in Miami Beach. The event was open to the public. Many Hasidim and Yidlach from New York and other places who were wintering here in Miami were also in attendance. And most of the people sitting on the dais were people whom I knew and recognized. There were Rashivas, Rabbonim, Mechanchim. But there were also a number of new faces, apparently prominent Rabbonim, people I never saw, people from out of town who also took seats on the raised platform. Sitting next to me on that dais was an elderly gentleman, a Yidl with a board, Payas and a strimal. He looked familiar. I couldn't quite place it. Every now and then I forget a name, but I never forget a face. I studied the man intently, and all of a sudden it hit me with absolute clarity that he was the very same individual who created emotional havoc for the Holocaust survivors who are now long gone, the very same people that I davened with years earlier on that frightening Pesach night. My brain emitted a quiet scream that reverberated with the cry, "What is he doing here?" His presence on that stage was inappropriate and incongruous. Where was his audacity coming from? With his past and less than sterling reputation, how could he possibly delude himself into occupying such an imaginary, undeserved, inflated place of self-importance? "What is he doing there?" is the refrain that continued to play itself over and over again in my mind. I am certain that everyone here in this room tonight, at one time or another, has either witnessed or learned about an individual whose presence or participation at an event was so out of place and so stuck out like a sore thumb that it triggered the visceral knee-jerk reaction of "What in heaven's name is he or she doing there?" Maybe you remember the reaction of Elie Wiesel in 1985. He learned that President Reagan was going to participate in a wreath-laying ceremony at a cemetery in Bitburg, Germany. 49 members of the Nazi SS, Yimach Shemam, were buried there. Elie Wiesel said, and I quote, "That place, Mr. President, is not your place." Or as we would have chimed in, "What are you doing over there?" The truth of the matter is that this very, very normal reaction is a subject that is of serious concern to our Torah. And strangely enough, this theme is associated with the hero of our Torah, the great lawgiver Moshe Rabbeinu himself. At the very beginning of Sefer Vayikra, Moshe Rabbeinu is summoned. We're told, "Vayikra Moshe," that HaKadosh Baruch Hu called out unto Moshe, "Vayedaber Hashem Elov Me'oel Moed Leimor," HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to him from the Oel Moed, from the tent of meeting in the Mishkan. Now surely at this stage of his career, Moshe Rabbeinu came and went as he pleased, by his choice, and solely at his discretion, he related to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam with an aspaklari amira, a totally unobscured clarity of communication denied to any other Navi. Why should there be a need for the Rabbeinu Shel Olam to make it known that he was summoning and calling out to Moshe from a specific location? Moshe could confer and speak with HaKadosh Baruch Hu whenever and anytime, wherever and whenever he pleased. But the Medrash says something quite remarkable. Say Olmad. Moshe Rabbeinu avi ha-chokhma v'avi ha-neviim v'loi nichnas lifnai v'lifnim v'loi kriya. Imagine, Moshe was the greatest of all prophets. There never arose, nor will there ever be another Navi like him. Through his angel agency, miracles and fabulous wonders were wrought on behalf of the Jewish people. He ascended the very heavens to bring down a Torah. He orchestrated the building of a Mishkan. He understood the hidden, most esoteric secrets of Torah. And with all that, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam still had to make it known that he was summoning him, that he was calling him. Even Moshe has to be called. Why? Because otherwise, says the Medrash, "Haysatayna shel Talmud Chacham blidas." People would see him hanging around the Mishkan. They would say, "Egeit arum anakop." He's walking around without a head. He wasn't summoned. He wasn't told to be there. It's not his place. It's not his business. What is he doing over there? The depth of this message is brought out beautifully by Rav Hutner and Pachad Yitzchok. There are many words in Lashon Kodesh which mean cognition or knowledge. There is chachma, wisdom. There's bina, understanding. There's seichel, intelligence. But there is a unique type of cognitive ability which is called das. And Chazal tell us that this particular nuance speaks to the mind's capacity to at once cleave and unite and connect with an idea, but at the same time to have the ability and capacity to distinguish, differentiate, and ultimately disassociate from dangerous concepts. It should therefore come as no surprise that at the conclusion of every Shabbos and Yom Tov, we insert into the Shemoneh Esrei a tefillah called Atah Chanan Tonu, where we make a verbal avgolah, we differentiate between Kodesh and Chol, the sacred and profane. It is not by accident that this tefillah is inserted by the bracha, where we ask for das. For as the Gemara says, "Imein das, havdolah minayin." A mind that can truly identify with the concept will hopefully have the capacity to distinguish, differentiate, and ultimately reject antithetical ideas. Let me put this into very simple practical terms. Suppose you were to see an individual reputed to be a great tzaddik, virtuous, pious, saintly, a venerable pillar of rectitude, and you observe this person spending considerable time in a terribly, terrible, improper place. Your initial reaction would naturally be, "What is he doing over there? Why hasn't he distanced himself from a place where his own value system should dictate that he have no association?" Logic would then dictate that you should see this same individual the very next day giving a shiur in this shul. You would say, "What is he doing over here? Inain havdola das minayin." He cannot properly differentiate and distance himself from impropriety. How can he possibly have the capacity to cleave and unite with propriety? If I am incredulous, if I am shocked when I see him at a place where he shouldn't be, I am equally stunned and mystified when I see him at a place where he should be. Moshe Rabbeinu had a calling. He needed to be summoned so that every one of us should know that he was possessed of das. He was always able to discriminate between where he should be and where he shouldn't be. He was never in uncharted territory. He was always in the right place. As we prepare for Kabbalah Satorah, we also desire Dveikus Batorah. It is therefore essential that we strive to be Talmidei Chachamim Sheyesh Bahem Das, that we internalize the lessons of Hagbolah and Hafrosha, that we develop a deep attachment to Torah by retaining enough humility to respect boundaries and to know that there are parts of Torah and Ruchnias that are beyond us. But more important, let us be discerning enough to understand that Shavuos and Matan Torah connect us to others and forebears who exercise the wisdom to be Mavdil Ben Kodesh L'chol. As we ready ourselves for Kabbalah Satorah, let us resolve to know exactly where we stand in life, where we are. That the Torah and the Beis Medrash is a place where our presence should continue to be a familiar and ongoing reality. That like Moshe Rabbeinu, we should never, never be strangers in uncharted territory, but rather we should have an uncanny, fine-tuned sense of discrimination to appreciate that life for us Jews, is a Vayikra. It's a response to the sound of a sacred calling at Har Sinai. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Have a beautiful, beautiful Kabbalah Satorah, wonderful Yom Tov. Chag Sameach. Okay.